Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Hope is here.
Hello.
And we are doing the next in our series of episode-length discussions of a particular show. Last time we did Haruhi Suzumiya. This time we're tackling the epic known as Clannad. Clannad, however you want to say it. And we are joined by a volunteer at... I think a listener of the show occasionally, his invalid name on Twitter, it's Chris Adamson. Chris, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, Zach. Thanks for having me. It's really cool.
Yeah. So you sort of volunteered to pop on to talk about Clannad, and I'm grateful for that because this is a show with a whole lot of very dedicated fans, and we didn't really know what we were going to get when it was like, hey, Twitter... we need a guest for this show. So we're very happy to have you on. To begin, I just want to point out that part of the reason we immediately went to Clannad after Haruhi Suzumiya is because to this day, Clannad After Story, which is the second season of the program, is still, I believe, the third highest rated anime according to the Anime News Network Encyclopedia of user votes for greatest anime of all time.
Right. When I watched it, it was number one, and it has since been knocked off by Steins Gate and Full Metal Brotherhood.
Right. Yeah. So, and given that we've been talking about how our next episode is likely going to be Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, maybe we'll just run down that list of 10. But I've always meant to see this because it has been a hype machine for, you know, since it came out. People have been talking about Clannad as though it is a masterpiece, as though it is something everyone needs to see, that it is an emotional roller coaster you will never forget, and it very, very ardent, very passionate fans. And so that is where my curiosity came from, and part of the decision to do this was just to give me an excuse to finally watch it. And what I'd like to do at the start here is same thing we did before. I want to know what your experience with the show was before you saw it. So did you watch it as it aired? Did you come to it on DVD? How did you hear about it first? And Chris, I want to start with you.
Well, I'm going to give you a roundabout story. And like many things, I blame Robotech, which is going to take me back a ways to 1985, which is when I first started really getting into anime in college. And for anyone who's my age, I'm 47. That show, the only part anyone cares about is the Macross part. You know, it's this big old space epic. And then 25 episodes in, there's this big old war. Mostly aliens, mostly humans die. And then it drops into like 10 episodes of soap opera. Mm-hmm. And it's like you'll have a whole episode where it's just, you know, Claudia, the bridge officer, telling her friend how she met the love of her life and all this stuff. And it's a completely changed tone. And I imagine most people who are watching this show for the mecha battles and stuff really hate it. I said, God, I really like this. This is like nothing else I have ever seen. I want more of this. Didn't find more of that for a long time. Kept watching anime on and off over the next, you know, couple decades. And I think somewhere in the 2000s, I was watching the new type discs as they would come out, and you watch every new episode on those. And
well, to clarify, so people know what you're talking about there. There used to be a magazine called New Type USA that would come with a DVD that had an episode of anime, an episode or two of anime on it. That was a long time ago, and I don't think people remember it anymore. So I just wanted to clarify that. Anyway, please continue.
Thank you so much for making me feel old. Yeah, and then, you know, before we could just, you know, get a Crunchyroll subscription and just stream all the things we want to try out. So I would watch, you know, the various episodes on that, and saw, and I was like, okay, I'm still open to the idea of seeing a drama. And I saw a drama on there called Rumbling Hearts. And I really liked that. And then a couple of years later, when Funimation put some of their shows on iTunes, I checked that out. And that was really my first experience with a dating sim visual novel based anime. And I really liked that show. It is just very intensely dramatic, very soap operatic. And again, really outside what I expected from anime. So then a few years later, we get satellite TV at my house, and we get the Anime Network, which is, you know, from the wreckage of ADV. And I see that, you know, the first week I get it, they're showing Clannad After Story. And that is, you know, number one on Anime News Network. And it's, I think I got into the first or the second episode of it, but I basically caught up with it as it was airing on Anime Network. So I actually watched After Story without the benefit of watching the original Clannad. I just jumped in, you know, watched those first couple little, you know, the first part of After Story. We'll talk about, you know, as we get to that part of the show. Sort of like, okay, what's the big deal here? Why is, you know, how could this possibly be number one? These are some, you know, very simple little stories about the people around the school. And then you hit that point where the main character starts, you know, he graduates from high school and he gets a job, and all the other things that happen in After Story happen. And I just really was captivated at that point, that it was like telling this very rich, very personal, very emotional story. And once that ended, watching it via DirecTV, you know, basically next time Right Stuff had a sale on Sentai, I immediately ordered, you know, the original series and After Story and the movie, and then just watched all of them straight through. Because at that point, it's like, you know, you've won me. And I just really, I think I happened to have the good fortune of seeing the good part first. And not all Clannad fans feel that way. There are some people who will defend the first season and specific arcs in the first season. For me, the meat of the show is the second half of After Story. That is just, you know, I think that's transcendent. It's remarkable in just how committed they are to the emotions and the themes of that show. So I just happened into the good part, and that really won me over.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Discovered it on the Anime Network's cable channel. That is
The video on demand channel.
The VOD channel, right? Yeah. Right.
Justin's going to laugh at me because he thinks nobody watches VOD.
Right. Well, you know, Anime Network does still exist, so that's
going to be their pull quote, right?
Right. Yeah.
Anime Network, it still exists.
So that's interesting. So Hope, what was your experience with Clannad?
Well, I also had a weird, like, not very common experience with the show, which is to say that it came out, it was airing in late 2007, early 2008, which normally, the original show was, not After Story, but, like, normally, I don't really remember dates that specific, but I remember for this one, because that is when I was in my senior year of high school. And there were several Japanese transfer students that, like, I kind of became friends with. And they were all girls, and they were really into Clannad. And it wasn't for the, you know, you think of Clannad, you think of the key media, and you tend to think of a stereotypical, like, oh, basement-dwelling otaku who collects pillows or figures or something like that. And that's not the case. Like, that show was a big hit primarily because it appealed to a large group of fans, because it was mostly a comedy. Like, there isn't explicit fan service in it, and the reason that these girls loved it was they thought it was really funny. And I didn't really get it. They had me watch, like, the first five or six episodes, and I didn't get it. Like, I didn't get what was so funny. And, I actually get the humor more now than I did then, because I'm more entrenched in, like, anime culture, so I understand it more, but I definitely didn't get it at the time. But in between seeing that and now, I saw Air, and I saw Kanon, and I saw Angel Beats, and I became very familiar with the work of Key, what the demographic was. Like, before, I was looking at Clannad, and I wasn't, like, entirely sure who it was even for. I didn't know it was based on a visual novel. I didn't know that it was, you know, I didn't know about that medium and it was meant to appeal to, you know, older male demographic. I didn't get the romance games. I didn't get it. So coming back to Clannad, now I had all this experience with Moe and the Moe boom and like hating it, and then over time kind of becoming less hateful of it and going, yeah, it's okay, and it's largely over. And so this was like looking back at something that I had technically missed. Like, I'd never watched more of it than that first six episodes that I saw, but I felt like it was going back to that time because I saw at that time Aaron Cannon and Haruhi Suzumiya as well, and all that stuff that you associate with that. It just, Clannad specifically, I had skipped because I had it forced on me, and usually when stuff is forced on you, you buck against it. So, yeah, like, I watched all of Clannad and After Story just in the past month or so in preparation for this podcast, but was introduced to it when it was a brand new thing in Japan, and all these girls were super excited about it, and, you know.
Yeah, my experience with Clannad is largely secondhand, sort of observing it as a phenomenon that was happening in the industry that I worked in, it was a big thing at the time. You know, the Moe boom was happening, and that was the show everybody was shitting their pants over. And I didn't watch it because I never cared for Moe stuff, and that had come to be kind of the prototypical show. Like, you know, when you talk about Moe anime, Clannad is like right up there at the top in terms of shows you will mention first.
Yeah.
Or at least what pops into your head. I largely ignored it. I, you know, figured it wasn't for me. And then After Story came around and people really lost their minds. And I actually reviewed, quote unquote, the first episode of Clannad After Story in a preview guide, rather disingenuously. The preview was during a particularly contentious guide, and I had written it as the only objective review. So it is, I like the show as much as you do, if not more or less. That is what the review says. I didn't watch any After Story or anything, but people really, you know, they really clung to it, and then it, you know, it slowly made its way to number one on the most beloved shows on our encyclopedia list, and I had always kind of meant to go back to it. It's one of those things where I see a phenomenon like that, and I will always be curious. I'll always be curious. Doesn't matter what it is. I will always be curious. If that many people love something that much, I'm going to want to know. I'm going to want to know for myself. What am I missing out on? What did I not see? I want to understand that. I was, you know, happy that we had sort of decided to do these episodes of this podcast, so it would give me a chance to go back and look at some of that stuff. And Clannad was, like, right up there at the top. Like, okay, this is wildly popular, or was wildly popular. Now I would imagine it is widely beloved, that's kind of it. I was not watching it as it aired. I didn't watch the DVDs as they came out. I didn't partake until the last month, where, like, I watched it in preparation for this. I did watch it in big chunks, so I would watch the nature of having to marathon something. I got through the first season in about 5 days. Second season in less time than that, because the second season is more compelling to watch, so you want to keep watching it. And then the movie was I watched as a curiosity, just as a, well, what is that then?
And everybody else.
Just so I could understand it. And also we should mention that the game is actually getting a release over here just now through a Kickstarter campaign. That is wildly successful, like funded almost immediately. Some donors giving as much as like $7,000 each. Mm-hmm. Like, just still obviously made a big impact on a lot of people. So, you know, it's scarcely needed to say why we're talking about Clannad. So with that, I kind of want to just let's get it out on the table here, just up front. What overall, when you walked away from the show, just if you could sum it up in one sentence, did you like it the whole thing or not? And Chris, let's start with you.
Well, you know, filling in my role as the Clannad superfan on the show, I've got to say, I would summarize as saying, I described this show to my wife and I cried when I did it.
Really?
I think that's all I need to say.
Okay. Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
It just really hit me.
And that's the entire thing, all 50 episodes.
And I'll admit, you know, the headcanon version of Clannad to me is sort of a best bits of season one and good part of Afterstory. As you said, a lot of us feel that, you know, Afterstory is the really the compelling part of it. There are things to enjoy throughout it, but God, that second half of Afterstory.
Right. And Hope?
Well, yeah, I cannot sum the whole thing up in like one feeling, because my feelings on different parts of it are widely divorced.
It's a very segmented show.
It's very segmented. So, okay, so Afterstory, from that would be episode 9 of Afterstory to the end of it. Extremely compelling. Watched the whole thing in a day. Greatly enjoyed the experience of watching it. It doesn't mean I thought it was amazing. It just meant I enjoyed the experience. And Clannad, as in episode 9 of Afterstory up to the very beginning of Clannad, I didn't care for it at all, except for Fuko's arc, which I thought was compelling. Like, you had to, like, wait through the wasting time filler comedy bits or exposition bits that weren't working. But the meat of Fuko's arc, if you could, like, edit it down, I would say is also compelling. Everything else I could throw in the trash bin. I didn't care for it. So, but those parts, like those specific chunks, I would say worth seeing. Definitely gave me a lot to think about and discuss on this podcast, certainly. But yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of great character animation. I'll say that. Like, lots of great character animation. And if it didn't have that, I probably wouldn't have been able to watch it so easily. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember there was an AMV Hell a few years ago where they took that one scene of, you know, the second time you're back at the bottom of the hill and Tomoya calls out to Nagisa, and just, you know, the degree to which his mouth expands when he calls out to her is just so well animated. Of course, in AMV Hell, that turned into the song "Bitch, I Love You," which is just perfect for AMV Hell. But yeah, just the facial animation throughout Clannad, where people are looking at specific times, what you can read in their eyes and their mouths, just consistently throughout the show is really sharp.
Yeah, I for my part, I'm with Hope on this one. I'm sure this will come as a massive surprise to everybody listening. Didn't think it wasn't for me. I feel like I understand it now, which was the purpose of all of this for me. I just wanted to understand it, and I feel like I have a good understanding of it. I know what it is. I feel like I have a very good handle on why it was popular, why it's so popular, why so many people liked it so much. And the last half of Afterstory, like I said, is very compelling television. I enjoyed watching that. Parts of it angered me and made me really question the writing, the writing quality and the skill of the people writing the show. But it was admittedly dramatically more interesting than everything that had come before. And to me, the experience of watching it was interesting and compelling and engaging enough to where I didn't regret deciding to go on this 50-episode journey, I guess. But overall, if you ask me, oh, what did you think of Clannad? I almost said Clamato.
What does it mean? What does Clannad mean? Did they ever say
I don't
that?
Know.
Oh, God, that's an atrocious story. Apparently, Jun Maeda thought that Clannad was the Gaelic word for family because he was aware that there is an Irish folk group named Clannad.
Right.
In fact, he is wrong about this. The Clannad is a contraction in Gaelic of the clan of some certain part of Ireland. So it's, I hate to quote TV tropes, but it is unfortunate English. Mm-hmm. They completely screwed up the title. And I'm sure the fans of the Irish folk band are not happy that every time they Google for their Irish folk music, they're getting this Japanese anime instead.
Well, if you type it into Wikipedia, they do come up first. You have to click to get through to the anime. or the visual novel, rather.
That actually helps a lot, though. Like, I really wanted to know what the title was supposed to mean. Now I know it's supposed to be foreign, cool-sounding word for family, which tells me a lot. But, yeah.
Right.
If only they hadn't screwed it up.
But, yeah, in the end, if you ask me, like, what did you think of Clannad? Well, it sure is a TV show. Like, it has some stuff in it I absolutely hated. It had some stuff in it I thought was okay. I mean, I don't know. It's 50 episodes and it's extremely segmented. So let's get into that these segments then. With the first, let's start with the first season, obviously. And the first, what, 8 episodes? 9? Is just Foucault?
Yes.
Well, there's a little bit of place setting before that. I mean, the Foucault arc really settles in around 3 or 4. You have a lot of character introduction to do before that. And I remember back when Brian was writing Answer Man, he had one of the Answer Fan segments was, you know, what's the best first episode you've ever seen? And I wrote in and I said Clannad. I love the first episode of Clannad. It has a lot of work to do setting up, you know, pretty large cast. But it seems like that first episode really gets into its groove easily. You know, it does the things you're going to see from the show. It's got Tomoyo kicking the crap out of Sunohara. It's got the gag with somebody telling Sanai how bad her food is. I really like, actually, before even the opening credits, there's basically a thesis statement for this show. It's, you know, you start with Tomoya's monologue. You know, I hate this town. I'm miserable here. I go to school, I hang out, and the one place I don't want to go is back home because my home life is even worse. And then he meets Nagisa, and Nagisa is just doing her little talk about, well, there's good things and there's sweet things, but they're all going to disappear eventually. And it's like, oh, well, thank you. You've just introduced yourself as the literal personification of Mono no Aware, and now I know what this show is going to be about. I like the confidence of that first episode, that it knows what it is going to be from the very first seconds of the show. And it helps that it's a visual novel. You know, they know exactly how it's going to end. The last scene of the show is actually teased in the opening credits of the first episode. So, you know, before we get into Foucault, as we're introducing the characters, introducing Tomoyo, and introducing, you know, the school environment he's in, you know, they do a pretty nice job of setting that up. Foucault might be my least favorite arc, so I sort of think kind of fall off quickly after that. But I do like those first couple episodes where you're sort of learning about the environment they're in and who these people are.
Yeah, well, it introduces the harem of visual novel girl routes he's going to go through. Yeah.
Right.
And you know, they all have their one-dimensional personalities. and then there's the introduction of the, I thought, almost universally not funny comedy. There's a few okay jokes. Clannad, actually, it is a romantic dramedy, I guess, to a fault. There's a lot of sitcom humor in this, and it's generic anime sitcom humor. So, like, a lot of it. And
the fans
really
like that. You know, the fans are into, you know, Sunohara getting his ass kicked when he says something stupid. The fans are into the fact that every time Kotomi plays her violin, it's going to be like setting off a nuclear weapon. You know, the fact that those jokes never change, for the people who dig the show, that it only makes it better.
Yeah, I understand that, but if you don't think it's funny,
then it's going to fall really flat.
It is Kotomi's violin. It's Kotomi's violin to Kotomi being the fan of Clannad, and it is Kotomi's violin to the people who don't get it, like everybody else. You know, it's like, oh, get through this, like get through this, and get to something, you know, that works. Because if the comedy doesn't work for you, then that's a huge chunk of the show. It is a lot of sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have never thought that the girl, punches guy, he goes flying thing was ever funny, and they do it in the first half of the show, really throughout the first season, constantly, and it's not funny. So that totally fell flat for me. Frankly, the Yohei character, Sunohara, I guess is what people refer to him as, he served little purpose, I thought, overall in the show, other than as a contrast to the sort of serious lead. I didn't really see what purpose he served. His character arc isn't particularly interesting.
No, his character arc is... I thought he would be more interesting if they gave him a dramatic... Because everybody's got a dramatic character arc, so Nohara's no exception. If his dramatic character arc was different from Okazaki's, but it's not. It's the same thing, but with different trappings. He and Okazaki go through the same thing. They just have opposite personalities. And it's like... But I don't find most of he's there for comic relief, and I don't find abuse of Sunohara that is endorsed by his best friend to be funny. So unfortunately, that's the only joke. So
yeah, well, and Frank, actually, now that I recall this, the culmination of his character arc at the beginning of in the first half of After Story, I thought was some of the worst material in the show.
The thing with his sister,
you mean where he's going out with Nagisa's
sister,
mom?
I forgot about that. I was thinking more like the stuff in the middle where they're trying to get the student council president elected. That was stronger, but the stuff with his sister in After Story was terrible.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll get to it. So okay, so I guess we're coming at this from like, well, we didn't really like this stuff, but it really spoke to you.
Well, let's get into Fuko then.
Do we have to?
That is such a long arc, too. I mean, it starts around 3 or 4, it goes to 9. It's like, how long are they going to spend carving starfish, right?
Well, right, actually, yeah. the thing I want to talk about with Fuko's arc, and just so people understand. So the story at this point is, like you said, depressed teenager who doesn't like his life or his town and has an abusive sort of alcoholic pop. And so doesn't like going home.
He's not like beats him abusive. He's like neglectful. I don't care about you. I've shut off from the world.
Yeah, and they fight and stuff. He goes to high school chock-a-block with moe girls, and the first one that they focus on extensively is Fuko, who acts like she's 5,
yeah,
6. Looks like she's like 9, and carves these starfish and keeps trying to give them to people. And that's the premise, I guess, at the top of the show. Mm-hmm. But the thing about Fuko is she's like an astral projection or a ghost or something of a girl.
Coma ghost girl.
Of a girl who's in a coma.
Yeah.
And this is where the show introduces its supernatural elements, which only seem to pop up from time to time.
About 3 times. Now, the supernatural elements, they are technically laced throughout, but all of them that happen all the ways that the supernatural affects the world could actually happen in the real world, except for Fuko's arc, the dorm mother's very short arc story, and the ending of the whole show. Apart from that, it's technically magic that's doing things, but it's magic that's doing things that could actually coincidentally happen, like what happens to Katomi. So Fuko is the only really magical thing. Her and Dorm Mother and very end of After Story.
Okay, but up front, it is childlike moe girl who is actually a ghost and is being projected onto the world through these subconscious comatose wishes of a girl in the hospital, and her sister's getting married, and she wants people to show up to the wedding, and so she's handing out she's making these wooden starfish and handing them out to people, and that takes a really long time to resolve. Right.
Oh, does it ever.
Yeah, so
You can sort of see in retrospect, there's actually some alternative motives to this arc. The main purpose of that arc is that Fuko, more than anyone else, pushes Tomoya and Nagisa together. She's the one who insists that they refer to each other by first name, which, right, you know, in Japanese is a pretty big deal. The whole working on carving the starfish together is what, you know, cause them to spend so much time together. I think they eventually, you know, fall asleep together, but, you know, don't sleep together because it's not that kind of show. So I think in retrospect, you can sort of see that's actually laying some groundwork for the Tomoya-Nagisa relationship later. But, you know, in the moment, it sure seems like, God, we spend a long time, you know, carving these starfish. And then, oh, hey, I just forgot Fuko. Because once you realize who Fuko is, you can't see her anymore. Mm-hmm. And so eventually everybody ends up forgetting Fuko by the time we get to the wedding.
See, I liked that. I did think that was – oh, and I am specifically – I should clarify. Episode 9 of After Story, all of After Story, that is really compelling. I did actually have trouble getting through Fuko's arc, but I will take Fuko's arc over literally all the other arcs in the show, because I did think that there was a conceit there. Like, with Katomi's, I thought it was poorly written, and I thought the Sunohara's was poorly written. I didn't like those others, but Fuko, I liked the concept of the starfish being her placing her memory in other people, and when they look at the reality of who she is, they're unable to recognize her anymore. And it was playing with a nice sci-fi concept, this Heisenberg uncertainty principle sort of thing, where something is there, but you can no longer perceive it, so it is not real anymore. And if nobody perceives it, it ceases to be. And the way that they... And it's not... That all by itself is nothing special, but the way they built to it was scary, because it started with everybody knowing who Fuko is and thinking she was really cute and funny, and now it's just the named characters, and now it's even fewer named characters. And the part with Sunohara specifically, like, talking about her as if she exists, and then she doesn't, and then she does, and then he gets tired, and he's like, I have to lay down, like, I have to go to sleep, I don't understand, because he's like, his brain is switching between different perceptions of reality, and it was spooky, and I was like, okay, that's cool. And it is meaningful, and it's sad, and the stuff with, you know, it doesn't make sense, sure, it's a supernatural thing, but at least they're sticking to the conceit. And the stuff with Nagisa's mom, who actually can't remember or see Fuko, but she really wants to, like, she wants to believe in it, so she fakes it. And all of this stuff was, like, kind of character revealing about these other characters in their responses to Fuko. So I thought that was a something. Yes, it does go on too long. Yes, it's packed with meandering comedy, sitcom stuff, and setup. But I still liked it more than the other girls' arcs. So, you know, like, okay. I liked it more than the other girls' arcs.
I think in these episodes and in the middle of the first season is where I sort of realized what the show's real strength was when it comes to that. Now, I didn't personally find the material to be funny, but what I thought it was tapping into was an idealized pals hanging out at school, and they have girlfriends and guy friends, and they all hang out together, and there's love triangles, and they have in-jokes, and they have adventures, and it's an idealized sort of high school life that captures, I think, the spirit of what high schoolers think they're social circles are like or should be in high school. Yeah. I think it
or for the fans of this show, it'd be what they wished their high school had experience had been like.
Yeah,
these shows are very much built of nostalgia and, you know, what you thought your high school should have been like, you know, because it's like, you know, I had no friends in high school. Nobody liked me, but this is what it should have been like. I'm going to pretend that I lived in Clannad Land. You know,
I
totally see that. I think that's, you know, particularly in Japan, that's really the fan base for this stuff.
Yeah, and that's very obvious about this show, I think. Yeah. But I think it does a pretty good job capturing that idealized life and speaking to that audience. I personally thought it felt like I was reading a high schooler's idealized version of their high school life, and I don't find your in-jokes funny, I don't find your antics funny, right. I don't think your adventures are very interesting. You think this is, but I don't. And so that was sort of my personal reaction to it, but I understood the appeal of it and how it would appeal to a pretty big audience, because it captures that really, really well, I think. Mm-hmm. For someone who wants that kind of escapism, which I don't, it's pretty good. It's a really good example of that, I think. And I can see why it's appealing.
I think it would actually appeal to me more. I'm okay with that kind of escapism, that kind of melodrama. I mean, there's lots of people who don't love melodrama. I shouldn't say who doesn't, but I do love melodrama. I don't think it has to be necessarily realistic. I think escapist media can be fun, but for me, the biggest problem was just that it is so based in comedy that is wasting time. It's sitcom comedy that's like buffered to make the show last longer because the actual dramatic story points are honestly not enough time is spent on them. Sometimes they just rush headlong into an emotional climax without quite enough build up to it. You know, certainly not characterization, which that's my biggest problem with the show, but I'll save that for later. But my second biggest problem is there's so much comedy and like one out of 20 jokes made me laugh. Like, 19 out of 20 were like pure pain, and then 1 out of 20 worked, and they only worked because of KyoAni's animation. Like, there were some good physical comedy bits in there that were solely due to the character animation, and that's what made me laugh, but the written humor, like, just full-on bombs for me personally, so...
Well, to be fair, there's 5 jokes. They just tell those 5 jokes, 20 times each.
Yeah.
So the mileage you get out of seeing them do that joke again is diminished if you don't think it's funny. But so the Fuko arc gives way to the Kotomi arc. Kotomi being the also incredibly childlike, toddler-esque. Girl who hangs out in the library with no shoes on, appears to be developmentally disabled, but is instead...
Well, that's all the girls.
But is instead that's a genius. Is instead a genius. Has a tragic backstory that you learn about, and is generally sort of taken out of the running as Tomoya's girlfriend over this arc, and they sort of help her deal with her shit. Mm-hmm. Over the next, what is it, like 4 or 5 episodes, something like that?
There's about 5 episodes per character.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, did, early on. Were at this point, were you just sold? I mean, did you like the Kotomi material more?
Oh, I think Kotomi is my least favorite part of the show, and I apologize to everyone who's going to rip me in the comments for whom it's their favorite part, but the Kotomi arc to work at all requires such an unbelievable suspension of disbelief. The core element of the fact is that, you know, we will learn halfway through the Kotomi arc that actually Tomoya and Kotomi were best friends when they were little kids. In fact, she was his only friend, and he would go over to her house all the time, and then her parents were always going away for work, and then she got lonely and pissed off that they were going to do their important scientific research about finding out about alternate realities, and so she decided to burn their house down with all their work in it, and he discovers her in this fire, and then they're rescued, and then somehow 18-year-old Tomoya does not remember being in a burning house with young Kotomi. And that is, you know, key visual arts trope number one is that traumatic amnesia is going to be in almost every key Annie show or key visual arts. It actually turns out to be an important part of canon. It turns out to be an important part of Angel Beats. I think you could argue it's an error. It is very convenient for Key to just to withhold information from the viewer by having the main character not remember it. So that is a rather extraordinary suspension of disbelief to think that Tomoya has just, you know, blocked this experience from his mind. I found that completely implausible myself. I imagine you guys did too.
Yeah, well, that was my second. I was willing to maybe accept that he had forgotten that because maybe he was 4 or 5 or something. And yet, like, sure, like, that is completely, I'm agreeing with you, it's bad writing. Like, it's bad writing. But I was more okay with that than I was even, it gets even worse. Who was, Kotomi was not taken into custody or given to other guardians. She goes from having burned her own house down to living by herself, seemingly.
Yes, and this appears to be an open secret among the people who work at the school, and yet it is completely unknown to all the students.
And why? Like, there's no way that would happen. There's so, like, zero explanation or rationale for it. Like, there's just, yeah. And I agree with you, by the way, that Kotomi's arc is the worst part of Plenad. Like, straight up. I don't even have to think about it. Like, well, maybe. No, it's the worst part. It's even worse than, the second worst is Sunohara's sister, but, like, that Kotomi's the worst because it's pointless. It doesn't really, it relies entirely on coincidence. Yes, coincidence caused by magic, but still, well, we don't know that till the end of the fucking story. And it relies on her going from a 5-year-old who burned her house down to, like, okay, now she's 17 or 18. All these years in between, she just lived alone? Where? Like, who were the guardians?
Raised herself from 5.
Raised herself? Yeah. We don't know. And that's supposed to be the explanation as to why she's so lonely and messed up. But, like, there's no practical explanation for this. Like, it's just ignored for the sake of convenience. And I think it's the worst... I think it's actually the worst melodrama that Jun Maeda's ever written, because usually he has more rationale than that. Like,
Well, you haven't seen Little Busters, have you?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, like, you can lower your bar once you see that.
Okay. Air Cannon, which I know he only wrote half of Cannon, but Air Cannon, Angel Beats, Clannad, now my experience with him, like, he usually has more rationale. Even if the rationale is magic caused by the other side, it's more than Kotomi was given. Kotomi is given just so little rationale. It makes no sense. It doesn't work emotionally. It is a waste of time. Even the violin joke, usually they tie... The starfish joke is tied into... it's another Jun Maeda thing. Like, it seems funny, but really it's sad. Like, the explanation for the joke... we'll get to the big one in After Story there. Like, the explanation for the joke is actually tragic backstory. For the violin, she's just bad at the violin, and she's obsessed with playing it for some reason. Like, it doesn't... Even it's bad writing. Kotomi's bad. So,
Zach, would you like to share your thoughts on the Kotomi arc?
Through line for me on all of this is that none of the female characters are given anything to do other than have their one personality trait, have their little quirks, and be weird babies.
Yeah,
weird. Grown babies. Like, I don't understand the infantilization thing. I never have. The characters in this are like archetypal baby waifus. Like, they're just... Kotomi is maybe one of the worst ones in that regard, just because of her weird habits and the way they present it as kind of like, oh, she's so cute and childlike, and she acts like she's a dumb four-year-old. Mm-hmm. And it's off-putting.
Not even a smart four-year-old.
It's off-putting to a weird extreme. And
now the actual five-year-old in this show is more on the ball than Kotomi is.
Right.
That's kind of a problem.
Yeah, right. And it just doesn't like that type of character is very common in moe stuff, and I really don't like it. I don't find it compelling. I don't think there's any escapism there. There's no fantasy. I don't want to be around girls like that. That seems terrifying and frustrating. So this sort of continued the, oh, all of these female characters are just bizarre baby waifus. It's super weird. Anyway, so the Kotomi arc, once it resolves and you get through that, oh, he just doesn't fucking remember that? Okay, whatever.
But he cleans up her yard.
Raising herself. What?
Yeah, he does all her landscaping for her, and they get her a new violin, so that fixes everything.
Yes, right.
I mean, actually, to me, I think the other thing about this, the Kotomi arc, that is just unbelievable suspension of disbelief, is when you finally get to the suitcase that's delivered by the old guy with the mustache, and that, you know, this apparently somehow survived the plane crash that killed her parents. And it had the teddy bear in her there that Kotomi wanted as a child, and a note from her parents, and it just, you know, says to bring it to their child. And somehow it has made its way across the world, passed from person to person, country to country, you know, more treasured than like the Dead Sea Scrolls or something.
It's supposed
to be this very heartwarming story. And I will admit, I looked at it and said, are you freaking kidding me?
That's bad, but I'm okay with it because it does have an explanation, and that explanation is the magic of the wishes of the people of the town, which is the same reason the Fuko exists, which is, like, that's magic. That's what I meant by there's magic in the show, but it usually causes coincidences. That's one of the coincidences. But it is directly explained by they show the magic light wish ball when it happens, so we know that's what caused it. So, okay. Fine, Clannad, you can have that bit of bad writing, but it's still bad. You know?
Yeah. Okay, so moving on from the Kotomi arc, the show kind of dicks around for a little bit until you get to at least the beginning of the main girl, Nagisa. Mm-hmm.
We're sort of skipping over to Moyo. I mean, it's really short, but there's the whole she's running for student council to save the cherry blossoms that were precious to her brother. And, of course, tragic backstory there. Their parents were going to divorce, so he tried to kill himself, did not succeed. But as far as we can tell, he's limited to a wheelchair. And so this, you know, she has to win the student council presidency because somehow that will allow her to save the cherry blossoms. I'm not sure what kind of student council has that kind of power, but they sure do in Clannad.
Right.
And then she's got her bad reputation from being, you know, a history of violence student. And, you know, Tomoyo helps clean up her reputation. She wins the election. But then, of course, you have the scene at the tennis court where, you know, we finally see that all the girls are loving Tomoyo. But when Nagisa gets hurt playing tennis and he goes and runs to take care of her, everyone starts crying because they realize they've all lost and he's made his pick.
They all cry. That is such a, like, I see that linked on YouTube as emotional scene from Planet, and it's like, the context of this is literally a bunch of harem girls crying that the main boy doesn't love them. That's terrible.
Well, like, it's important. Well, okay, the thing that's important to point out about Tomoyo, mm-hmm. not it's fucking name the character Tomoyo. The lead character is Tomoya. Come on.
They're meant to be together in one of the alternate timelines.
Apparently, like, she's either the second most popular or something mm-hmm. girl in the game. Because all of the OVA episodes and special episodes that center around alternate timelines, alternate routes, are the lead character dating Tomoyo. Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, she got a whole sequel as a visual novel, Tomoyo After.
Right.
So, you know, if you play that, it basically ignores After Story and posits that Tomoyo ended up with Tomoyo, and they have this whole other history together.
Right, yeah, and that's been animated. So, like, she's sort of significant in that regard. In regard to the actual, like, main through story of Clannad, she's not important at all.
Well, the main through story of Clannad, no one is important except for Nagisa. Now, people are given roles in propagating it. Like, people are given roles in pushing them together, like you mentioned with Fuko earlier, but they are not in of themselves important at all.
Which is the inherent awkwardness of watching a show that is trying to adapt something that will tell one of four or five different stories, depending on the choice you pick.
Yeah.
And they want to animate as much of the story in those segments as possible without following through with the romance.
Yeah, well, if we're going to hop into this point now, I mean, that's always been, you know, sort of what I wish Clannad didn't do, and I think Clannad has to do, which is that they have to show every single arc, because this is as much a souvenir for fans of the visual novel as it is a standalone show in and of its own right.
Yeah.
And that appears to be what people think is the model for visual novel-based shows. It's certainly what Little Busters does. It's certainly what Canon does. It is not required to adapt a visual novel in that way.
No,
I can think of a couple counterexamples. Diamond Daydreams is a visual novel adaptation that eliminates the male protagonist altogether. And it just turns into a series of little vignettes about all these girls around Sapporo who were visited by the main character, and they just take him out, and you get a completely different experience by doing that. I mentioned earlier Rumbling Hearts, which I adore. They picked one arc. They said, the interesting arc is this one. We are going to let the others fall by the wayside. We'll pick maybe bits out of those, but we're going to pick the one that we truly believe in. And that's another way to do it. But, you know, Clannad, Canon, Little Busters all said, we have to do each arc in order. And because we have this single main character, we're sort of blocked on, well, he can't do anything with Kitomi because he's working with Fuko now. He can't do anything with Tomoyo until he's done with this arc. You know, so there are other ways to do it. I guess a third example would be F, Tale of Memories, Tale of Melodies, where you have multiple male protagonists so you can tell stories in parallel. That's another way you could approach this. But, you know, when you have a visual novel and you have the single male protagonist and you feel that you have to capture all of it for the sake of your fan base and your viewers, yeah, you kind of do get stuck in this. We have to do this arc. We have to do this arc. We have to do this arc. And it's a problem because, as you were saying, you know, we're working towards getting to Nagisa and the drama club. Well, it's what's set up in episode 3 is Nagisa wants the drama club. But first, oh, Fuko, can we have a drama club? No, we got to do Kitomi. Can we have the drama club back? No, Tomoyo. And it's like, can we have the drama club back? Okay, yeah, now after 19 episodes, we can get back the drama club that we set up back in episode 3.
Right. Yeah, and that's, you know, and I totally understand that. Like, I understood what I was watching. I was watching a adaptation of a visual novel that was trying to make the fans as happy as possible. I accept that. It's just that from the perspective of somebody who is not watching this just as a souvenir, just as a supplemental material to this thing I've already experienced, it's a bizarre experience watching the show that is just clearly spending time on these stories that don't appear to matter.
They don't.
Really at all. Oh. And there's one main story, and it farts around for episode after episode until getting to the goddamn point, mm-hmm. which you do after the Tomoyo stuff.
And where, oh, what a blunted point it is.
Yeah, and so...
Well, You know how there was that one guy who did the machete order for Star Wars that says you should watch episodes, what is it? You should watch like 4, 5, 2, 3, and 6. I keep imagining there is a machete order for Clannad that you could just pare it down to the Nagisa story and you would do like 1 through 3, 19 through 22, maybe the first episode of Appa story, and then 9 through 22 of After story. You could make this perfect one season of just the Nagisa storyline,
right?
And just lose all the harem elements, you lose everything else. You could almost make that work.
Yeah, you're right. I think, and they would have to be reanimated in order for that to flow properly. But yeah, I get what you're saying. But anyway, so moving into the proper Nagisa storyline. We learned that her parents have been keeping from her that she has, I don't know, tragic anime girl disease. It's never made clear what Nagisa's actual...
Oh, I know exactly what she has. Did you ever see the... There's an old movie way back when with Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw called Love Story.
God.
And that's... Tragic lovers, and she gets sick and dies. I think it was Roger Ebert who coined the term Ally McGraw's disease, which is a disease in which a woman gets progressively more beautiful as she dies. And yeah, that's what Nagisa has.
Yeah, right. It's tragic plot disease or whatever. But mm-hmm. So she has this, and she wants to put on the play anyway. And they put on a play, and the play is related to the magic bullshit that's happening in the background, right?
We haven't even mentioned the illusionary world to this point, have we?
No. So the illusionary world is this... I don't know. You explain it.
The illusionary world is magic because it is animated on the ones. You know, that's
right,
the first thing you need to know is this is the best-looking part of Clannad. The illusionary world consists of... it starts out with just the interior of a small shack that has a table and a chair and one girl in it. And we get this narration that this is a world that has ended. It has no living things in it. Well, even though there seems to be perfectly viable plant life outside, but there are no sentient beings in it until after story. But there's a girl in it and she can build things out of junk. And she basically assembles this little robot friend. The robot friend cannot speak, but she can communicate to it by asking questions, and it can, you know, nod its head or shake its head back and forth. And these scenes are seen from the point of view of the robot. So we slowly find out that this is a world where, you know, life has ended and the world itself is going to come to an end soon. So the two of them have these sort of conversations. They sort of, you know, try to understand their situation, but it's very slow moving. We only check in on them every couple episodes. But as we get to the Nagisa plot, she sort of seems to remember this as a story that she's heard and that she wants to dramatize that as a one woman play. And you guys want to take over from here?
Yeah, I wonder where she got that story. I hope the explanation is extremely fulfilling.
Yeah, okay, so... Anyway, they do this play, and then he confesses to her afterward, and that's when they're officially a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then the big thing that happens here is the fact that prior to the play, her father reveals to Tomoya that, you know, she was sick as a child, and that, you know, the Nagisa's parents had their own careers, had their own lives, but when she was sick, they left her home one day so they could both go to their jobs. Nagisa went outside to wait for them. She collapsed in the snow. He had to, like, you know, go and pray for her to get better. And she did, but that's the point at which they realized, you know, we can't have lives of our own. We have to dedicate ourselves to our daughter. So that's why they quit their jobs and they moved to this little town, wherever it is that Clannad takes place, and they opened the bakery. And sort of this comes out of Nagisa and Tomoya are looking around in the shed behind the Furukawa's house. And the father, Akio, says, you know, don't mess around in there. You don't want to find what's in there. Because what they eventually find, and worst of all is Nagisa finds it, is she finds an old videotape of her father when he was in high school as an actor in a play. And her dad wanted to be an actor. He was going to be a professional actor. He was pretty damn good, frankly. And she realizes that her parents gave all that up for her. And so that's what, you know, when she finally goes on stage in this play, she completely freezes and starts crying because she realizes, like, everyone has given this up for me and I don't deserve it. And she's just completely frozen. And then the big dramatic moment in that episode is that as she's frozen on stage, her father runs in from the back of the audience and says, you know, you've got to do this. You know, you are my child. You are the reason that we did this. You know, your success is our success. We didn't sacrifice anything for you. You are the reason we are here. And it's this, you know, if you buy it, it's this very heartwarming thing. And then that gets her to, you know, repeat the, you know, the monologue really from the first episode where she's imagining this play in her head where she says, you know, shall I take you to the place in town where dreams come true? And then that gets her into this story of the illusionary world. The one thing I want to mention here I just really love is just a tiny little detail is the fact that when they're watching or when Nagisa's watching that play on the old VHS cassette of Akio, her father acting, he's doing Oedipus Rex. And I think that's just a nice piece of foreshadowing because Oedipus is a man who unintentionally destroyed his entire family. And that's pretty straightforward foreshadowing given what happens in After Story.
Also given that Nagisa has her mother's face and Okazaki has dad's face. Like, they have different hair, but that's literally it.
Yeah.
And well,
to me, like, the remarkable thing about all of this is that we get through all of it, and at the end of it, Nagisa still has a character depth that's about a half an inch deep.
Okay, right. So this is, I said my second biggest problem with Clannad and the reason that it couldn't really work for me, and I, you know, I didn't think it was good. I just thought it was watchable once you got to After Story. Up to that point, it was kind of agony. But agony, and then you get to After Story, and I finished the whole thing in a day because it was very compelling. But prior to that, the reason it didn't work was, number two reason was the comedy, but the number one reason is, as Zach has touched on before, these women have no character. I've seen moe shows where they are given some character. Jun Maeda has written stories where he gave his female characters distinctive, like, arcs and traits and stuff like that. And these, no. Like, even the most, like, so Tomoyo and Kyo are the only two that are not actually baby. Like, all of the female characters are babyish in their understanding of the world and their reliance on the male character in the way that they express themselves. They're all weird babies, except for Kyo and Tomoyo, but they are weird babies who know how to put out the visual, like, the outside perception of intimidation. But it's like Tomoyo is tough on the outside, but if you peel away that layer, she has the exact same emotional, like, puddle depth. Yeah, just puddle depth emotionally that all the other baby girls have. And the same is true of Kyo. Her only her only trait, she's tsundere, and her only trait is that she wants her sister to be happy with the man that she loves because she, you know, she knows that they're both in love with the same guy, so she wants to give him to her sister and can't do that, and it breaks her heart. That's her only character trait. Like, so yeah, that's the reason I could not connect with Clannad, just couldn't do it, is because, apart from the lead male who was given, like, everybody is one note. The girls are especially kind of eerie in their non-humanness. And, but even some of the guys are non-human except for the protagonist. Like, he's the only one allowed to have any character traits. And everybody else is this weird one note. Like, they all seem to know that he's the protagonist in this story, and their lives revolve around him, and they're endlessly patient with and hang on every word he says, and he can magically solve everybody's problems that he sort of half-heartedly walks into and says, well, if I gotta, you know, that destroys it for me. Otherwise, I would be way more forgiving of even the ridiculous magic plots and all that stuff. But without the characters, it can't work.
So. Yeah, I don't care what happens, because the lead character, I would have to somehow find him to be the compelling Superman that everybody else in the show seems to think he is, and I don't. And nobody serves any function in the show other than validating everything he says and does constantly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the ultimate self-insert in terms of, you know, in terms of the personalities of everybody else in the show, and indeed the world he lives in, exists
literally
to revolve around him, and he's not interesting as a person, so it's kind of a whole lot of nothing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so after that point, they go through this play stuff, the first season ends, get into the second season, and let's briefly get through these first 9 episodes so we can get to the meat of the story here. The show, once again, farts around for 9 episodes.
I think what it's doing here is it's burning off the last of the arcs from the visual novel that everybody seems to have. You know, you've got Yukine, who's sort of the godmother to the local gang. She's got to get 2 episodes. You've got the who's the woman who's at the Tsunahara's dorm
mother.
You know, her and the cat, the dorm mother.
Yeah, the one who fucked the ghost cat.
I just want to say this sentence really badly. Dorm mother's story is dorm mother almost fucked a human version of a cat when she was in high school, but she didn't, and now he's her cat. That's the one sentence version of the arc. And
that
it's
was
literally
what
happened.
It's fucking absurd. I mean, that whole story arc is fucking absurd. It's funny. It made me laugh, and I'm glad I watched it because I was like, "What the shit is this? Like, when are you going to get to the point?" But I'm glad you're getting this weird, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super weird.
I liked the weird. I liked it when the show got weirder, which it did with Fuko and with Catboy, who was literally a dying child's cat made human by his last wishes. But he has to give that wish to somebody else, and when he does give that wish to somebody else, he becomes a cat again. But that's okay, because the person he gave the wish to adopts him, and it's like, but you almost fucked that cat. You were in love with him, so that almost happened.
Yeah.
Let's not forget this, you know.
The other notable thing that happens is Tsunahara's little sister decides that he's not moving forward in life, so he needs a girlfriend to whip him into shape, so they pimp out Nagisa's mom to pretend to be his girlfriend. And it's gross and weird, and she doesn't really have a reaction to it at all other than, that's weird. That's it. One line. They're totally just pimping out her mom, and she's like, oh, I don't know about this. And that's it. And at the end of this, not only is he under the delusion that he's dating her mother, although he thinks she's someone else, as though he's never met her before,
they lied to him from the beginning and said that it was Nagisa's sister.
Yeah, well,
so he thought that for a really long time.
Tomoya and Tomoya has to try to convince him to give a shit and do something with his life by pretending to date his little sister, who looks like she's like 7.
She's literally everybody looks like they're little, but if you can tell me that their ages are a certain way, but she is in her first year of middle, she's 6th or 7th grade.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's be grateful this was an all ages VM. Yeah. Okay, let's just leave it at that.
Well, the game was all ages too.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's There's just no gross that all of that happens in the same like episode.
In the same space.
They sort of get all that stuff out of the way. So anyway, so that's the first 9 episodes. They're still fucking around. And then eventually they get to the actual story, which is what everybody talks about when it comes to Clannad, which is the last half of After Story, so it's episode 9 forward. And at this point, it's getting into material, and I can see why it's compelling, because it's getting into material that not a lot of shows based on visual novels and not a lot of visual novels ever even touch on, which is, okay, you picked your girl, now what?
Mm-hmm.
And in this show, he becomes an electrician.
Well, he's supporting.
Well,
you know.
He becomes an electrician, and they get married, and they have like a life together. And for a few episodes, there's domestic bliss where he's just sort of working, and she's dealing with his schedule.
When you describe it that way, it does sound boring, but it's not.
I didn't think it was boring. I thought it was compelling. While I was watching it, I thought for a second that maybe, oh, is this designed to be kind of like propaganda, like for Neets and like Hikikomori, where it's like, oh, you can marry your high school sweetheart, you can marry your moe sweetheart, and get a job and function and pump out some kids, because we need that to happen.
I kind of actually had the same reaction when I was watching this show, you know, knowing what the situation is with, guys in Japan who are into 2D girls,
right.
You know, they're being hikikomoras, they're being neets. Yeah, I sort of thought, it's like, God, did you guys get like funding from the government for this show?
Yeah.
A little bit of social engineering through anime. What you describe is a little reductivist, because let's remember, you know, what Tomoya's personal arc is here, and that's really where this pays off in, is where his personal arc is that, you know, he has left his own home by this point. He's living with the Furukawas. once he graduates from school, you know, we hear that, you know, all the girls, infantilized as they may be, they at least have some sort of realistic plans for what they want to do after school. You know, Kyo wants to be she wants to be a teacher. Ryo wants to be a nurse. Sunohara is still a dumbass and thinks he's going to be a model. Good luck with that. And this drives home the point to Tomoya that he has no idea what he's going to do. He graduates into just sort of a pointless oblivion. The Furukawas have him start working for them at the bakery. So he starts to have this sort of gradual coming of age where, you know, he's gone from being a delinquent to, well, he's got more of a family than he used to have, because, you know, I've always thought that Tomoya was attracted to the Furukawas by this idea of a functional family that he never had, because, you know, his mother died when he was, you know, very young, and his father tried to take care of him, but eventually turned into a drunk pachinko player, alcoholic loser. So he sees in the Furukawa sort of this idealized family, and, you know, he gradually becomes a part of that family. And then, finally, you know, the big breaking point for him is, you know, he gets a job as an electrician to, move out from the Furukawas. And that, is also prompted by the fact, and it's sort of set up way back in the Fuko arc, is that he asks, Yusuke for a job. And Yusuke is the guy who married, Fuko's sister's name? Something Ibuki.
It doesn't matter.
Anyway, yeah. He's her husband. He's the guy who got married on that day at the school. So Tomoya asks him for a job. He gets a job. He starts to make those steps, perhaps a little bit inadvertently, towards being an actual adult. You know, he's come from being a delinquent, no friends, to being a somewhat competent, having some number of friends. He's starting to hold down a job. You know, he can now pay for his own apartment. So he's sort of drifting into the things that we expect a young person to do with their life, and, you know, move out of the house and freaking do something. But the breaking point for him comes to the fact that, you know, he does very well at his job, despite the fact he's got the injury where he can't, you know, move his good shoulder. That's why he can't be a basketball player anymore. It's because he got injured in a fight with his drunk dad that one time. So he basically does very well at his job. He's offered a promotion, and right then his dad gets arrested. And I guess in Japan, this disgraces you when a family member is arrested. Yeah, so the promotion that was offered to him is rescinded just because of his family shame. And that moment drives him to propose to Nagisa. That's the point for me where he just, you know, completely renounces his own family. He wants to be with the Furukawas. He will do that by marrying Nagisa, by starting a complete new life with her. You know, within his own experience, this all kind of makes sense.
I think, and during that, you're doing when you explain it like that, I think it goes a long way to explaining why this is compelling. What's actually happening on the outside is not, I did say that Okazaki is the only character with, like, traits that are interesting and develop, and he is, and the minute after story starts, it's all about him. Like, it is... up to that point, the story has been about these periphery girls who are, like, not anything close to almost a realistic dog rather than a realistic person. And, like, you know, like, but once he gets to after story, it delves into Okazaki's character, and he has character, and he has an arc, and he has traits. And it led to my favorite scene in the entirety of after story is actually in the whole thing. In fact, I think the most dramatically effective part of the entire show is Yusuke's backstory, which he tells to Okazaki, and that's a really important scene because it takes it gives Okazaki the understanding of why he is doing all this stuff. Because at first he takes on the job, he's watching his friends grow up without him. He takes on the job, he's going through the motions, and he doesn't seem to understand why he's doing it. So Yusuke asks him, "Well, why are you doing this?" And he's like, "Well, so I can provide for a family, I guess. Like, so I can raise the money for..." And he's explaining in just very practical terms why this makes sense as the world has explained it to him. And Yusuke tells him his story of becoming a famous rock star who apparently Okazaki's never heard of, but I kind of believe it. I'm like, sure, he doesn't know who this guy is. Like, maybe he was... That stuff is ephemeral, and maybe that happened before he was... Like, when he was little, and he doesn't know who this guy is, and, you know, he's moved on from that life, but whatever. So Yusuke apparently used to be a favorite... he used to be a big rock star. And he, got into music he got into playing the guitar because he loved a woman, and he loved Fuko's sister. And so he continued to pursue the guitar and become famous because in the back of his head, he's like, well, I will get this money and I will become successful in the world's eyes and then I will earn her love. And it destroys him. His record label, he becomes very popular, but then one of his fans goes on like a killing spree or kills himself in a very violent public way, saying that his songs caused him to do it, so he has to change his music, and then he becomes depressed and he starts taking drugs and he has a huge falling out, and then he just crashes out of this life, and then he comes basically crawling back to the woman, and she says, I like it when you play guitar for me. And now he's just an electrician, but he's with the woman, and he said, you should do whatever you're doing to make money for these people and not for the approval of whatever the world is telling you to do this for. And that changes Okazaki's character instantly and reaffirms all of his decisions about why he's okay, why he decides to propose after being told he's not going to get a promotion and stuff like that. So I thought that was the strongest part of After Story, and it's all downhill from there. But, you know, that's me.
Oh, by the way, I looked it up. Yusuke's wife and Fuka's sister is Coco.
Yeah.
Okay.
Koko Ibuki, or later,
okay.
Koko,
so anyway, they get married. She gets pregnant, and she keeps telling the doctors tell her, "You're too fragile to have a baby. You're gonna die." And she's like, "No, and I'm not just gonna have a baby. I'm gonna do it at home without a doctor and no epidural and." Fuck hospitals and modern medicine, you know, like...
She doesn't say that.
I'm a twig that can snap in the wind, but I'm gonna give birth without any modern medicine at home. And wouldn't you know it, she kicks the bucket.
As I said about stretching of reality here, the fact that, you know, an ambulance in the snowstorm that happens, that's why they get trapped having this birth at home. And once things go bad, they can't get her to a hospital. You know, an ambulance can't get to her, but her parents can. And we find out later that, you know, Tomoya and Nagisa's apartment is clear on the other side of town from her parents. So that was one of these things. It was like, okay,
well,
I'm just going to cut you a break on this one, but come on.
Nagisa kept saying, like, I want to have this birth at home. Like, she says that a few times. That she wants to do it at home. So there's never a concerted effort to put her in a hospital environment. It's, oh, well, I guess this is happening here.
Yeah.
And so anyway, she dies, gives birth to a kid.
And the story falls apart for me in the next episode.
And then
we jump ahead a couple years.
We get a
little bit of a sense of what Tomoya has been doing this time, which is he throws himself into his work and he drinks and he plays pachinko. And for those of you who don't appreciate irony, he has basically turned into his father.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Meanwhile, having left his child with Nagisa's folks, apparently just completely abdicating his responsibility to that kid. And just fucking off for 5 years. And no one ever holds him responsible for this, by the way. Mm. It's just...
He's got a Tideland baby who doesn't seem to mind.
Yeah, and... God. Anyway, so 5 years pass, and basically he sort of decides that he's going to encounter this kid again, right?
Well, it kind of gets forced on him because Sanai comes over to his apartment and starts bugging him, and she basically intervenes and says, oh, hey, you should go out on a date with me, and hey, let's go on a trip together. And then they set it up so he comes over to the house, and you know, they're not there, and they've got tickets for this trip, and then the, you know, Akio and Sanai are not there. He finally has his first interactions with his daughter in 5 years. I actually kind of like those scenes because it's kind of scary. He is really cold to his own daughter.
I liked it from his perspective. I understood why he was acting that way. I did not like the way that the world reacted around him to that, but
if you're a father and your wife dies in childbirth and you basically just abandon your kid to her folks for 5 years, first of all, fuck you.
Yes.
Fuck you. And no one in the show ever tells him fuck you.
No.
No one ever says that. And it takes me out of the show completely because there's no consequences for his actions. And it totally just reiterates what my problem with the show is in the first place, which is that the entire world exists to validate this asshole's actions and opinions and everything about him. And this is the ultimate sort of example of that,
yeah, that
where he just decides
moment.
To not raise his kid. And the world is like, oh, yeah, poor you. Your wife died.
And the reason...
Fuck you, man.
the narrative reason for this, it was really frustrating for me because up until that point, I was enjoying Afterstory. I didn't know why it was... I'd gotten over the melodrama. I had gotten over the pacing. I had gotten over the fact that every character is nobody except for Okazaki, and everybody exists just to support him. Until they started dealing with material of that weight, which is to say that he has a daughter... and gets so sad that he has to abandon her for 5 years. And that's fine. Write a father abandoning his child for 5 years. That's okay. But the rest of the world can't react to that. Or you know what? Fine, if you want to be completely horrible and unrealistic and validate this asshole by having the grandparents be okay with it. Like, not even the dad. Which the dad, I thought... if Sanae was going to be forever forgiving of this, okay, I guess that fits her character. But the dad isn't upset by this? He totally would be. That is ridiculous that Nagisa's father would not have horrible, like, would just, you know, be angry at him because he should be. But, like...
Yeah, there's never even... And I'm not... We're not saying, like, oh, they should drag him out into the street and watch him get hit by a car.
It's just resentment.
There should be underlying resentment. There should be some negative emotion heading his way. Mm-hmm. The parents should have been given... a little bit of extra depth where they are at least subtly suggesting to him that he's been very irresponsible.
Yeah.
And that never happens.
It never happens. They're fine with it.
And it took me right out of the show.
And what's worse, but what makes it much worse, so nobody has this reaction to it. That's terrible. But on top of that, like, the child, she's a 5-year-old girl. And this 5-year-old girl's response to a man who is, they make extremely clear, has never entered her life, like, knows nothing about her. When he first shows up in the house, she doesn't really know who it is, and then she gets, oh, this is my dad, I've maybe seen him, like, 2 times. She gets that. But, like, she is fine with him coming to his realization after 5 years, I should raise my daughter, and he goes, okay, I'm gonna raise my daughter. And even if the grandparents, in their infinite stupidity and unrealisticness, decided to just give him the little girl, like, okay, yeah, you've been gone for 5 years, but I guess now that you say, I'm sorry, you can have this little girl. No, they would never do that. Are you kidding me? Even if they say that they're going to do that, like, the little girl would not, like, a 5-year-old is not going to want to live with a stranger she doesn't know just because people tell her, this is your dad and you should love him. If this is their first time meeting, I don't care if they had a wonderful vacation together, she's not going to go, okay, I'm perfectly fine living with this strange man and living in a house where she spends all day alone being just perfectly well-behaved, reading a book by herself while he goes out and does his thing. She used to live in a house where she was, like, doted on frequently by her grandparents and could play with them and, like, could play with other kids, and now she sits in this house alone so this asshole can feel better about his neglect of his daughter? You know, like, it just broke the show into, like, 1,000 pieces for me, where it's like, wow, this is the ultimate validation of this man to the neglect. He's an emotionally, like, Okazaki is an emotionally selfish monster, and the show basically says, yes, he should be an emotionally selfish monster, and the rest of the world will just coddle him.
And that's fine and justified because somehow he's owed that for some reason.
Because my beautiful man pain or whatever the hell. And it ruined it. And I was like, wow, I can't. This is not meaningful for me because all I can think of is the poor little girl and the need for some realism and some other characters, some resentment, some fear, some I don't want to live with the strange man. But no, she's like, oh, I've always wanted my daddy to come back. That's her attitude toward it. And it's like, nope. Nope, nope, nope. So I just exploded the show for me.
Okay, so, Chris.
Oh, yeah, own up to that, shall I? And Ushio is, you know, an unrealistically idealized child. You know, she is okay with everything. She never objects, you know, as you say. It's like, yeah, let's take you out of the only environment you've ever known, you know, to live with this father of yours who never sees you. Suspension of disbelief. That's all I got for you at this point.
But you were still hooked. You were, that didn't take you out.
I'm still buying it. I think because, you know, it is Tomoya's story. You're sort of buying into, you know, if you're not buying it at this point, you probably dropped the show back in the first season, you know, and you would be right too. But yeah, that's certainly problematic. It's not particularly realistic. But you know, let's talk about the vacation, because that is the moment that, you know, for a lot of people, that is this emotional high moment of Clannad, because Tomoya and Ushio go on this trip. He, like, barely look at her. He scares the hell out of her by yelling at some other parent's horribly behaved child. She goes off and cries in the bathroom. He buys her a toy at a stop. She proceeds to lose it off as she's playing in some flowers. And then the big emotional moment here comes from the fact when they arrive at this station out in the middle of freaking nowhere. He goes on a walk, leaves her in a field of flowers. It's apparently perfectly safe and fine in Japan.
just do it.
Lucky them. And then he meets his paternal grandmother, the mother of his father, and she asks him to forgive his father for being, you know, for failing, but saying, you know, he tried really hard with you. He, you know, he took you on trips and stuff, and you know, I'm sorry it didn't work out with him, but very romanticized there. You know, she's trying to really spin it. And we did see a little bit of that. The very first episode of After Story, right before the baseball game begins, we do see a little bit of this flashback to Tomoya and his father taking this very same train trip before his father turns into a drunk. So, you know, if you're buying the whole world from Tomoya's point of view, it's like this is this big payoff that, you know, he sees that, oh, God, you know, my dad did his best for me and failed. Now I am not even trying for Ushio and I'm a complete failure. I've got to make things right. And that's what, you know, brings him to, you know, come back to her in the fields and realize, you know, this is the kid I've been neglecting all along. And, you know, he says he's sorry. In real world terms, is that enough? I don't think so. I think Jun Maeda is counting on you to buy into the emotional truth of the moment. And you guys obviously didn't. I cut my anime a lot of slack, I guess. So there you go.
I just thought that him, like, wait here. I'm going to go for a walk. First of
for
all,
like an hour.
Yeah, okay, sure. Just leave your kid there.
Leave your five-year-old in a field of sunflowers.
Well, it's consistent with his character of abandoning his child.
Yeah.
Anyway, then he magically finds his grandma, just happens to be there.
She was set up there by Sanai. Whether she was like literally waiting all day just for someone to maybe show up from a train.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Convenience.
Yeah. Anyway, so all of that happens, and whether or not you cared about his relationship with his father or not, I guess it's up to you. I certainly didn't at that point. I don't think they spent enough time on that relationship to really give me any kind of emotional payoff.
Well, you know, but by that point, you know, it's all about Tomoya abandoning his father, leaving his father. When his father comes back after Nagisa's play, Tomoya won't even look at him, won't even acknowledge him. You know, he just utterly hates the guy, and you know, rightly so. But you know, it's very convenient that Ushio doesn't utterly hate Tomoya, given that he's become his father.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, what's happening in the illusionary world right about now?
I should clarify. I don't think it was, like, uninteresting or anything. I just didn't sit there and go, like, oh, man, I sure hope he forgives his pops. Like,
right.
I didn't care.
I would feel that way if I wasn't so angry at the world for, like... His grandmother is, like, a perfect microcosm of how this world functions. People just wait to be relevant to Okazaki's life. Like, they don't have anything.
Well,
it's like you just imagine to be invisible and then suddenly rendered in real time whenever he needs them. Like, that's how the world...
You know, and I can see the argument against that being like, well, yeah, the show is about him, but you're not generally supposed to notice that the fictional world completely revolves around the main character's wishes and desires and needs to that extent.
Isn't the illusionary world supposed to be the other one, like, not this one?
Like, when it's this obvious, it needs to turn into the Truman Show.
Right. Yeah.
Like, it can't be this obvious, and then that's just the way the world is.
Well, it's the tyranny of the visual novel adaptation. It's the fact that we have to see each arc in order, too. It's like, you know, these characters exist only as sprites with text boxes below them. That's the nature of making such a straightforward and such a literal adaptation of your source material. When we get to the movie, we can talk about a very different way of adapting this material.
Well, you mentioned, that's a tyranny of a visual novel. But other visual novel adaptations, even ones that take the exact same approach, do not necessarily have this characterization. Like, you are the special one, and we literally... Even if you are the special one is a thing, usually, like, in stories, other characters have lives outside of that. Even if you are the chosen one comes up a lot. Like, the chosen one narrative is very common. But, like...
Give me a good example. Do you think Steins Gate works that way, for example?
Well, Steins Gate is a chosen one, our lives revolve around your craziness thing. But they don't literally, like, he goes out of his way to change their lives and then is forced to change them back. The girl who is the daughter of the guy who created Akiba is, she has her own life. Like, she's not his life, you know? Even, and, Arisu, I don't remember the names, is the problem. His love interest, she has her own life. That kind of stuff. It's not... Clannad is so weird, it's so tonally odd, that it feels like Okazaki is walking through town, and it's like the Truman Show. Stuff is being rendered around him as it is necessary to him. That's how hardcore the non-characterization is for everybody but him. And it's like, ooh, it's weird, you know?
Right. Okay, so after this, as it turns out, Tomoya's poisoned dick and Nagisa's toxic incubator created not a child... but a ticking time bomb of tragedy porn.
Oh, no.
Because as it comes out, she has anime girl disease, too.
The same and dies. Thing as her mother.
She dies tragically in his arms.
She dies in one of Jun Maeda's other favorite things that I think is in all his work. I don't remember if it's in canon or not, but I think it is. She dies on one last walk with the person she loves most.
Didn't we see this in Angel Beats as well?
We saw it in Angel Beats. We saw it in Air. I think Air was the most effective one. But that Maeda loves that one last walk. It's always like, I just want to go for a walk today. It's like, don't do it. You're in a Jun Maeda thing. You know.
Well, so I brought up a second ago what's happening in the illusionary world, because throughout the second season, the girl in the illusionary world and the robot have been driven by this realization that the world is going to end. It's going to be covered with snow. That will be the end of everything. So they realize they need to get out. Since the girl can build stuff, they try to build a flying machine. It does not work. They decide, well, let's just set out on foot. Somewhere we will somehow accomplish some sort of escape by just walking really far. By this point, you know, we're starting to see these as parallel plot lines. So by the point that Ushio dies, the illusionary world plot has gotten to the point where the attempt to escape has failed and the girl is just covered in snow. She's basically dying of exposure. And little robot is saying, you know, God, why did I do this? Why did I bring you here? I've just caused all this tragedy. And well, golly, you know, the robot has the exact same epiphany that Tomoya does, that I've brought everyone around me to absolute ruin. Funny how those two things go together, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Anyway, that's the, you know, meanwhile, and having your cake and eating it too land, right, like that's right. What that storyline is there to provide, the crazy Deus Ex Machina that happens at the end of this show. Mm-hmm. So anyway, his wife is dead. His kid's dead. Everyone around him is dead because of his poison dick and everyone hates him. Well, not everyone hates him, but he's depressed and magical.
Everybody loves him, but he...
Everyone loves him, but magical light from the illusionary world sends him back in time.
The big bang of wishes. All the wishes that have been wished so far, this is the wishiest wish that ever wished.
Yes, and this is the final... This all happens in the final episode. So second and last episode, you're thinking, oh, wow, that's the tragic end of Clannad. But no...
No, that was the tragic end of Air, but not of Clannad.
Yeah.
Right.
So...
Which is why it worked.
He goes back in time and relives certain key moments in his life and has to choose whether or not he's going to still meet Nagisa and still go through with it. He's going to still go through with it. At this point in time, I was under the impression that this was going to be a really good, really strong message about how everyone goes through dark times, a harsh tragedy in life. We all deal with a lot of pain. Terrible things happen, but life is still worth living. And you live through those things and they shape who you are as a person. And sometimes life deals you a shitty hand and you just need to live through it. You just need to live through it and don't trade those choices for anything. Don't look back with regret or anger because it doesn't solve anything for you. Nope. It turns out, it's a Deus Ex Machina to erase the bad ending and have a good wish fulfillment ending instead, where Nagisa doesn't die and the kid doesn't die and everything's fine. And it's because so much love exists in the town, so much love because of Tomoya. Mm-hmm. That
well, and let's say, you know, what's happening in the illusionary world is this big reveal that the girl in the snow is actually the reborn Ushio, that the whole illusionary world exists because of her sadness. The robot is Tomoya. And so she starts, you know, telling her about the life they live together in this other world. She starts singing the Big Dango Family song. It's like, wait, I know this. And that's the very moment that whole world just ceases to exist.
Yeah.
And that's what brings, you know, Tomoya back to his senses at the bottom of the hill. And that's when, you know, he's about to let Nagisa go by. And, you know, because earlier when he was in his hikikomori phase, he has that moment where he's laying on his futon and he's just looking up at the ceiling. And he's saying, you know, I met this girl. We got married. We had a baby. That was all a big mistake. I should never have done that. I think that's one of the things that actually resonates with me about this show is that, you know, I think the show appeals to people who've had these kinds of bad experiences in their life, because he has that moment where, knowing, you know, that his, as you say, his poison dick has caused so much pain in the world, it's like, I can make this all not happen. And it doesn't even have to be a selfish choice. If he doesn't meet her, Nagisa doesn't die. He can do it completely for her if he just doesn't meet her. And then when he has that realization after the illusionary world ends, he just turns around and calls out to her. And, you know, she, you know, forgives him and says what a great life she had with him. So please keep going on. Hope, I think that probably would remind you of a scene in Angel Beats. Mm-hmm. That reminded me the last time I rewatched this, that this is just like after Yuri destroys Computer Room 2, when she's forgiven by her siblings who were murdered, and they tell her to go on with her life and let go of her burdens. So those two scenes felt a lot alike to me. Did you feel that?
I mean, yes, it's all themes that he's worked with before. Yeah. I thought Angel Beats, however, was the best thing he's ever written, and this was...
Yeah, I would agree with that. The other thing, of course, with Jun Maeda, you know, you always have this secret identity revealed at the last second that's, right. You know, reveals something that has maybe been staring you in the face all along. You have the reveal that the girl in the illusionary world is Ushio and the robot is Tomoya. You have the reveal, and I'm not going to spoil it, the last 2 minutes of Air, the last 2 minutes of Angel Beats. You know, and in the case of Air, it explains the show's logo. In the case of Angel Beats, it explains the show's theme song. You know, one of these like wild brain blowing reveals. This is one of the reasons people like his stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think you do start watching for it too once you know that that's coming.
In this case, it doesn't make sense though, because I do understand the logic of this. A lot of people just say, oh, it's just magic. There is an internal logic to Jun Maeda's magic worlds, which he uses the same magic rules in all of things, which means it's completely propelled by human emotion and karma and stuff like that. And in the case of Clannad specifically, it's one of those things. In Air, Misuzu was mentioned as like, for so many blessings to exist in the world, some people must be cursed. And Misuzu kind of takes up that mantle. And in Clannad, it's kind of the same thing, where it's like, this illusionary world has this eternal girl, and personifications of her are accursed in order to make... She has to be alone, you know, and Nagisa has to die. And those are just people who have to be cursed in order for other people's blessings and wishes to be granted. And that's just something that's in all of his stuff. So with that internal logic in mind, Nagisa was supposed to die when she was a child. But because her dad wished her dad and a separate person, and a lot of Clannad revolves around family and other people's wishes supporting others rather than yourself. A third party, her father, you know, wished for Nagisa to live even though she was supposed to die, so her life was spared. But that means the curse passed on to her daughter. The reason she dies in childbirth is just because she's weak as a twig. It has nothing to do with the curse. Her daughter dies at the same time that she should have died many years ago. So there is internal logic to this. By destroying the illusionary world and destroying that version of Ushio, the curse is lifted from Ushio, and Nagisa doesn't die in childbirth because that was the wish. So the wish wasn't for Ushio to live. The curse is separate from the wish that was granted to Okazaki. But my point is, it's crazy, dumb magic crap, but there is an internal logic to it. I don't actually have a problem with the internal logic of Jun Maeda's stuff. I think it works if you just have seen a lot of his stuff and you go, okay, this is how his brain works.
Okay, well, having not seen most of his work, to me, it was a bullshit cover so that the show can shove all this tragedy porn onto you.
Yeah.
And then at the last minute still give you the wish fulfillment happy ending.
Yeah.
That's all it was. Like, you're describing, oh, well, in the illusionary world, it's a girl and a robot, and here's the journey. None of that actually matters.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing that's relevant about any of that shit is that it allows the ending to happen.
I should clarify. I agree with you. I don't think it's emotionally rewarding. I think that it's one of those things where you create plot, just because you create plot logic for a terrible thing to happen, it's one of those things where people rationalize, oh, this can't be, there's like, oh, this work can't be racist or offensive or have a bad political agenda because it's justified in the plot. And it's like, that's not relevant. It's justified in the plot. It doesn't mean it's not emotionally manipulative, has a really upsetting, weird theme. The characters are paper thin. All of these are real problems. I think emotionally, Clannad is unfulfilling, to me anyway, like because of the problems mentioned earlier. But because so many people say, oh, Clannad is bad because it has a plot hole, I think that's way beyond the point. And it's not even really true, because it has its own internal logic. It just doesn't matter, because there's writing problems that are deeper than plot logic, which is not that important.
Yeah, so yeah, right. I mean, I don't consider this Deus Ex Machina when you've been setting up the illusionary world since episode one. I think the problem I have with it is that if Demoya is going to make this choice to accept everything that comes with meeting Nagisa, the reset button makes it not matter. Yeah. You know, it's like he chooses, knowing to meet her again, that, you know, you would think that, okay, if I don't meet her, she's not going to die, but I am going to meet her. And so now everything's going to repeat and everything horrible is going to happen. But then, surprise, reset button ending, it doesn't happen. So it's like he morally makes that choice to accept that. But then through a magical hand wave, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a real moral cheat of what the stakes are in the show, you know, for the sake of giving you a happy ending.
He's an emotionally selfish person. And I think that Okazaki is indisputably an emotionally selfish person. And I think that the ending would mean more if he either made a different choice in order to spare Nagisa's life and lived his life differently. That would be one thing. Or he committed to it. He committed to the arguably emotionally selfish, which, oddly enough, same choice came up in another Moe staple, the Haruhi movie. These protagonists always make choices like this because the world revolves around them, and it's weird. But, like, and women just sit there and are like, okay, well, you know, I love you, so I'll be the accessory to your emotionally selfish decisions, and that's the way the world works. But yeah, like, if he committed to it, they should have committed to it. And she dies in childbirth, and the only difference is he raises the baby from day one. They should have committed to that, and they didn't. So yeah, bullshit.
They did in the movie. We'll get to that.
Well,
sort of.
Well, sort of, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so anyway, so the show ends, and everything's happy in Clannad Town, and so that's
well,
that.
We also have a whole bunch of extra weird episodes hanging around for no particularly good reason. We have a recap episode. We have a year before episode. Then we have the two alternate universe episodes, which I think are only worth mentioning because the show wants you to believe so much that the alternate timelines count. You know, that's why, you know, Kotomi's parents were doing research on alternate timelines and alternate realities. There's a couple lines that Ryo has with her card reading or tarot, saying, well, I don't want to actually predict the future because then it's locked in stone. But if I'm always wrong, then different things can happen. And so I think that's meant to legitimize the idea that the Tomoyo timeline really happens, that the Kyo timeline really happens, that in the recap episode, when Tomoya is telling the story to Ushio, which is kind of bizarre, it's like, hey, I had this dream where mommy died and then you died. And I think it really happened, but, you know, you're 5 years old, so don't let that traumatize you or anything. But he does have his line there where he says, yeah, I believe it really happened. And I think Clannad really wants you to believe that all of those alternate timelines are equally valid. And they put stuff in their universe to say that this actually does all matter equally. And maybe that's just a sop to the visual novel fans saying, well, whichever path you took from through the game or whichever you think is best, girl, you know, we're still going to validate that choice for you.
Yeah, that's why all that stuff exists. But it is periphery. And in the interest of time, we need to briefly talk about the sort of anomaly that is the Clannad film. Like I said, briefly, and then we got to get to these Twitter questions. So, at the end of the TV show, you obviously described your reaction to this show as being very emotionally touched by it, and it made a big impact on you.
Yeah, this is a genre that has worked for me a lot. I think this fills in a lot of things I don't get from Western media. I think that's why I watch anime. I don't watch anime for superheroes or for sci-fi because I can get so much of that from the West. I do think that this genre of shows, not moe specifically, because that's such a broad thing. I mean, I don't think, you know, K-On! Really doesn't do anything for me. That's a very different kind of thing. But I do like, well, I guess I would call the romantic dramas for seinen particularly. I think stuff like F, like Rumbling Hearts, like Anohana, like Nagino Asakura, all really click for me, because they're scratching an itch in terms of they're clearly speaking to a male audience, you know, in some cases, you know, pandering to a significant degree, but they're scratching an itch that we don't get from Western media at all. And so that's something that I would be interested to see Western media take up some of these kinds of ideas and give it to me, you know, without the cultural barrier of coming from a different set of experiences. And I really don't see, you know, short of the ending of How I Met Your Mother, which everybody freaking hated, I don't see this coming out of Hollywood anytime soon.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And, you know, like I said, I'm glad I saw this. I think that anybody interested in moe as a genre, this is the show. This is the show you watch. This is the show you teach if you're trying to teach people about what moe is and how what the impact it had on anime and anime culture and the creative culture in Japan, creating anime and all that stuff. I think this is the show to watch. It also happens to be very compelling and engaging in its last third or so. And I'm glad I saw it. I had my problems with it, as I've outlined.
Yes.
But I didn't hate Clannad. And I, you know, ultimately, I think I'm better off as a fan of anime for having seen it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Did you have any sum up on the show?
Yeah, I didn't hate the... I thought it was really agonizing to watch the first season. But, you know, there were moments, and I didn't hate it at all. I think there's a lot to be said for KyoAni's production on it. Okay, visually, the sound element of Clannad is terrible. They use the same music over and over, like in the same beats in the same ways with no. The sound design for Clannad is not good.
But, yeah, how many times you get to hear Etude pour les petits supercord, which is Kitomi's theme? It's like every time she's asking dun 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 dun.
Yeah, it's almost tone deaf the way they use music. It's just based on who's on screen. Okay, their theme. Who's on screen? It's bad. Anyway, but like, so I got real sick of the music. But like, I think the visual production has a lot to do with how well that show works, and I enjoyed the act of watching After Story greatly, even if it made me really angry at points. It was compelling. It was interesting. It was. It made me think a lot. You know, it. I wouldn't call it good. I think it's written quite poorly, but I think that Jun Maeda is an interesting writer, and he is improving, and he has interesting things to say. It's just that his ambitions almost always completely overshadow his ability. So, yeah.
I'm kind of sad we haven't heard anything from him since Angel Beats. And I remember tweeting, I believe he may have run out of ways to kill sympathetic teenagers.
Right.
You know, right. Angel Beats really went through a lot of those, and now he's out.
Well, it went through production hell, and it's still going through production hell with the visual novel aspect. It was supposed to be a big multimedia project. It was going to have novels, and it was going to have a visual novel, and the anime was going to kick it off. And then the anime's episode run got cut in half, and it was done by PA Works, and that was not everything they wanted it to be. And I think it's just off kilter, and it's just in limbo. But that, you know, that was the best thing he's done, so I have hope for him. Angel Beats was the first time he wrote women that were people, and I was really happy about that. So I look forward to
maybe you guys can do a show about Angel Beats sometime. I would love to hear that.
It didn't have that much of an impact for like impact shows, but you know.
Anyway, so there was also a Clannad film that came out in 2006. So it came out in 2007. Yeah, it came out in September 2007 before the TV show aired. In fact, it looks like the TV show was announced when the DVD the TV show was announced when the film was being released or something like that. Or anyway, the TV show came after the movie. The film is directed by Osamu Dezaki, who also directed the Air film and a lot of other stuff.
Tons
and
of old things.
Before Air, You really wouldn't have pegged him as the guy to do this stuff. His production credit history is generally not filled with this sort of thing. And to it, the film is weird. It looks very different. The animation is obviously much cheaper looking and not as good as it is in the show. The characters are a little different. The story basically follows the Nagisa storyline. They get married. She has a kid. She dies. The end of the film is him deciding to raise the kid.
Yeah.
So that's the film storyline. The movie's weird. It's a weird artifact. I think people interested in it should check it out after watching the TV show, just as a comparison's sake, just to see that it exists. It is a... Yeah, it's weird. It's got that Dazaki thing where there's always a spotlight coming from one of the corners of the screen that floods the screen. And I think it's ugly, and I've never liked it when he does that. But it also has the grimy look of a Dazaki film. Like, it is considerably grimier than the TV show.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fucking weird movie.
And it's also before Kyoani kind of developed a house style for how to make moe girls look. So she... Nagisa is really perky and almost too expressive in this. The moe style of, I express a little enthusiasm, but kind of, you know, I have puppy face and I kind of keep my hands close to my chest. Like, that is not here. Nagisa is like, hi, what's your name? You know, like, she has a cute, perky voice, but she's outwardly expressive and her face is happy and, like, she moves more and she doesn't have the puppy moe that is now, like, the house style for those characters. So it is weird.
The other thing I think with the movie is, you know, the things that I hear people not like in Clannad, you know, take all those out and you kind of end up with the movie. Take out the harem elements. Take out most of the comedy. Take out the reset button ending. You kind of have the movie there. So you do get, this is the result of saying, let's just tell the Nagisa story straight through. I do like the fact it's told, as you said, it's really weird, Zach, because you sort of tell it chronologically, but partway through you have these flash forwards that get you to after story. So, you know, it's like we first meet them, they're getting together, she talks about forming the drama club, and suddenly we see a scene from after story. So it's going to be like 5 years later. And it's Yusuke in the electrical van picking up Tomoya during a rainstorm, trying to give him a ride home. And then he just, you know, says, hey, everyone's worried about you, man. And you don't know what they're talking about. You don't even necessarily realize it's 5 years in the future. And then he drops one line. It's like, oh, well, you know, everyone's watching out for you. We're one big family, like the big Dungo family, like Nagisa used to. And, you know, Tomoya's eyes light up and he just has to, you know, get out of the car and run off in the rain. That's like your first instinct. Oh, what is this movie really about? And you sort of clues you into the fact that as you're watching this, you are basically counting down to Nagisa dying. So it tells the same story in a very different way than the series. Doesn't really work for Clannad fans. I don't know anybody who's really into Clannad who likes the movie very much. I think it's certainly an interesting alternative. As you say, you know, watch the show first, watch this. Or if you're just into Dazaki, I think this is his last film.
It's not his last work, but it is his last film. He directed it after four Hamtaro movies and Air. But after this, he made Ultraviolet Code 44. And
Orson Welles ending up with Transformers as his last credit, right?
His last credit was Genji Monogatari. Yeah, it's a weird artifact. It just kind of exists. So if you watch all this Clannad, this also exists. I think you should take a look at it just because it is super weird. Anyway, we have to get to these Twitter questions. So let's get to them.
Yeah, it's taking a while. Yep.
Exodore US asks, how prevalent is the sex equals death morality play aspect? I don't think that's part of Clannad at all, really.
No, It's so, you know, we didn't even mention how weird the relationship he has with Nagisa is and that it's weirdly sexless. Like, they have to have sex to have the baby, but apart from that, they have Ricky and Lucy in beds and they make it really explicit that she doesn't, like, she passes him soap through the door while not looking at him while he's bathing, and they don't ever bathe together and they, like, never see each other naked. And they ostensibly had to procreate at some point to create the baby, but apart from that, they have this weird sexless, you never see them kiss. This is a huge, like, oh my gosh, romance thing where you never see the couple kiss. That's, well, you know, it's weird.
The reveal that they fucked is the weird baby waifu thing where she's like, their parents are sort of giving them views askance, and she's like, well, we're married, so that means we do naughty things, or whatever the line is. And it's like, you're adults, Jesus
Stop
Christ.
It. Yeah.
Anyway.
That's the curse of any of these shows that have a high school mindset. I know that, you know, compare Toradora to Golden Time. I loathe Golden Time. I freaking hate Golden Time. They're by the same author. But Golden Time is much more straightforward about having, you know, these characters have and talk about sex because they're in college. And it's just, I don't know if it's just a weird Japanese mindset that, you know, if you're in high school, that's not a thing. But if you're in college or you're married, you're adults, go for it. But the, you know, Kanad is forever trapped in that high school mindset.
It probably has more to do with all ages game.
Right.
Turns into all ages adaptation. But
well, that's why Sakai picked it up, because they're not going to do an 18 plus. Right. So, you know, that's manga gamer's job.
Anyway, Kit Kat Addiction asks, what's the biggest thing the show does right beyond the technical aspects? For my personal taste, it's compelling melodrama is what it does best, and that what I was talking about earlier, the sense of capturing what an ideal high school life that will be very appealing to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. When the writing is not so bad that it can't suspend it, it's compelling, well-executed melodrama.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, it's melodrama, and that's not something we see in the West very much at all. At least we don't accept it as melodrama. That tends to be a pejorative for us, even though our greatest cultural hero is a man who saw his child saw his parents killed, and now as an adult he dresses up a bat and beats up criminals. And that's in no way melodramatic, apparently. But we don't generally go for that in the West. So I think that it fills a hole for us. That they're really committed to that in a way that we just don't see over here at all.
Well, no, you do. It's just, it's only aimed at women. It's not aimed at men. It's aimed at women, and specifically it's aimed at older women. Like, yeah, there's media made for older women that has the same kind of plot logic, the same kind of dialogue, the same kind of, I guess, approach to emotion and the expression of it. But it's very different in how it's executed because it's for a completely different audience.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Got a lot of questions asking how people feel about the dub. I did not watch even a single episode of this dubbed, so I don't know. Obviously, I think, Chris, you watched it dubbed.
Yeah, I did watch it dubbed. This was like the first Sentai show I watched dubbed. I think prior to that, I was just happened to be watching stuff from other studios. I remember around this time I was watching Princess Tutu and Macross Frontier. I watched both those subbed. I like the actors in it more than I like the script, although that got better. I think Stephen Foster was originally involved with this, but he's not involved the later episodes. And I think Foster had a blog post or an interview sometime recently where there was a lot of hate aimed in Clannad's direction. I like David Matranga as Tomoya in particular. He's just got a good masculine voice. I guess the thing where it falls apart for me is, you know, Sentai keeps using the same actors in everything. So I went right from this to Angel Beats, and you have almost all the same actors in slightly different roles. And eventually Sentai to me kind of becomes like a community theater where you've got like 10 or 12 actors and they're doing six plays a summer. And so you sort of see the same people over and over again in slightly different costumes, and that gets kind of grating.
Yeah.
So script's not perfect. I do like some of the key people. The voice actor for Akio, I don't remember his name. He's really unfortunately we got Greg Ayers as Sunahara, who I don't mind. It's just that Greg Ayers is in everything. And, you know, he's just so easy to pick out that, you know, kind of, you know, it's like, hey, there's that voice again.
It's distracting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It really is.
You didn't watch it dubbed, right?
I mean, I saw some of it, and then it was too bad. I couldn't listen to it.
Okay, so not a fan.
Blood shoot out my ears.
Yeah, Hope plus Stephen Foster. You know,
no,
what are you
going to
do?
Angel Beats dub, same thing. It has basically the same thing where, like, the script is barely like human English. It has weird grammatical peccadilloes in it and stuff that doesn't make sense. The actors sound like they don't
I think,
know
like,
why they're
Tomoyo's,
saying
Tomoyo's first line in his first monologue in the English dub doesn't even make sense. It's like where he says, you know, and then I go home. There's no place I'd rather never go again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like,
that's the whole script. It's just
what
like,
does that mean?
It's terrible. It's like it's to me, it's unlistenable. And I don't like I have a low bar for listening to dubs. Like So long as it as I can believe that it's kind of those characters, I'll listen to it. I have a high bar for saying, oh, this is really, really good. But I have a really low bar for listening to it. Like, I'll listen to the Escaflowne dub and plenty of old crusty dubs from the 90s and stuff like that. I'll listen to those. But I can't abide the Clannad or the Angel Beats because the script is, like, not even a how human talking English. Like, it's that terrible. So, yeah. Nope.
Okay. Cypher Scythe asks, for a dating sim adaptation, Clannad seems to have a fair amount of female fans. Do you agree? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I touched on this earlier. It's the comedy. It was real big with the style of comedy. KyoAni wasn't, like, super established at that point. I mean, like, this was late 2007, so they were just, like, their little airplane was, like, really taking off the ground. And so people were still real fresh on the KyoAni style of humor, and I do think that they're good with comedy. And, yeah, that's what it was, women like that.
I'm also under the impression, and it has been explained to me this way, that the Moe girls, are to at least some women, cute in the same way that Hello Kitty and little mascot characters are cute.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
That I don't think I've met anyone who felt that way.
I mean, those
I know that that's been explained to me before,
right.
So I have no reason to disbelieve it.
Yeah, I see a fair number of women posting to the Keystudios community on Facebook, which is very active. I will say this. I don't think I have ever seen a female Clannad cosplayer. You know, that's firsthand for me. I see lots of Angel Beats cosplayers. People are really into being, you know, members of the Afterlife Battlefront. So that's one where Jun Maeda really connected with the female fan base. I don't know that women want to be one of the Clannad girls. I don't think anyone really identifies with Nagisa or Kyo or anyone else.
Those costumes are boring.
Well, no, but identifying with those characters is impossible. You can find them cute like a Hello Kitty, but, like, yeah, like you say,
you don't want to be them.
I see Angel Beats cosplayers, and I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Those were characters with traits and arcs, even the women. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, last question from Fancy Hut, and I think this is a good place to end here. He wants to know, what's the best argument you can make for actually watching this series? And I like that question because we should point out, it is not a small-time investment to watch Clannad. It is 50 episodes long. It's long as shit. And it's not fast-paced. It is not... it's not an action show. There's no action in it. It is 50 episodes of sitcom and then melodrama. And so I'm curious, I guess, Chris, let's start with you. What's your argument? What's your best argument you can come up with to tell people, watch Clannad?
I say watch what you like. If there is no obvious reason that you would like Clannad, for God's sake, do not watch Clannad. It is not a show that is going to win you over if you were not already inclined to watch it. If you have seen things in other shows, I'll tell you one other thing that led me to Clannad was I remember with the first Full Metal Alchemist series, people were saying, yeah, this isn't really an action show. This is a character drama. I'm like, well, that's cool. This is like the best character drama I've ever seen. You could take out all the action. I'd be perfectly fine with this. You know, if that's the kind of anime fan you are, that might lead you to a show like this. But if, you know, if you are into action, if your favorite shows are, you know, like Attack on Titan, you are not going to enjoy Clannad. I am not going to make an argument that you should watch Clannad because you're not going to enjoy it.
I would say if you want to understand Moe, if you watch Clannad, I feel like on the other side of it, you will understand it.
Sure. But, you know, if you just want to understand the genre, I would be perfectly happy with somebody watching Air. You know, Air is not as good, but it is one quarter the length.
I think Clannad, yes. but I think you can make the argument that Clannad does have a lot of quality in it and will make you less dismissive of Moe as a genre, I think. I think it would. I really do. Like, I think you could watch that show and see, like, okay, well, it didn't quite do it for me, but I understand why people really get into this.
Right.
And I can see the quality that people are attracted to, and I get it. I think I feel like it's a good show if you just want to understand, if you're just curious. If you're just looking for casual entertainment, I'm not speaking to those people. Like,
no.
I'm talking about, like, if you're into anime as a medium and you want to know more about it and you want to understand the movements in it, because sometimes anime can be incredibly obtuse and obscure and difficult to understand the full context for something, I feel like if you sat through 50 episodes of Clannad, you would understand Moe pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what do you think?
Well, I mean, like, that's a pretty good reason. So, like, I mean, if there's another take that I can put on that, I guess you could also watch Clannad, again, if you're really intellectually interested in this, as an example of something, like you said, Chris, that does not exist in Western media, which is to say melodramatic soap opera, deeply fulfilling emotional escapism for men, particularly like grown men who are like older than high school age, just a little older than high school age, who have been through it and can find the retrofitted high school thing to be escapism. Like, if you want to see like what is a soap opera for a male audience, that doesn't really that's an entire genre in and of itself, like a little bit separate from Moe. And it's like that's what this is. If you want to see, like, this is this one guy's entire story and this is his fantasy and things that in the West we're told, like, traditional masculinity, this should not be your fantasy or whatever. But it's like, hey, if you want to break past that and see that guys want a lot of the same thing that, you know, housewives do, like, this is that. This is tapping into those desires and those feelings.
So, yeah, I mean, really, you know, there's that book that came out this year, Moe Manifesto, and there's a couple of the Japanese interviews in that. They say that, you know, the guys reading shoujo, guys being into Moe, they think of themselves as redefining what manhood is.
Oh,
you know, they're
boy.
Saying, well, this is not about rugged individualism. This is not about being a salary man. We're finding a different way. Clannad is kind of an example of that. Mm-hmm. So I think you can buy it at that level. This is, you know, a very different experience than you're going to find from anywhere else.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you see older women are mocked for reading, like, romance novels or watching their soaps or whatever. It's like, well, men have those desires, too, and this is what that's made for, and that's why it was hugely popular, is because it's like this untapped... I mean, if you want to reflect it back to gender again, like, people are like, man, why was 50 Shades of Grey so popular? Why was Twilight so popular? It's badly written. Sure, but it's tapping this nerve that was not tapped enough. People weren't tapping into this huge market that was, you know, that wanted this kind of thing.
I experienced this show in my 40s, and I think the other element of it that it may appeal to people is the fact that this is a show that understands your suffering. You know, whatever you've gone through in your life, you know, people in this show suffer. They have sad backstories, you know, and particularly After stories about, you know, I saw this show, you know, after I had a child who was born with a massive heart defect and had open heart surgery when he was 4 days old. You know, we've gone through a hell of a lot, and nothing in Western media acknowledges my pain. And Clannad acknowledges my pain. It says, you know, everyone's had a tough road. This is what somebody else's tough road is like. I just feel like, God, somebody understands what I feel. And I think that's really something that clicks for me. I think that's what clicks for a lot of other people. I think a lot of people out in the world, they have, you know, alcoholic relatives. They've lost family members. They have long-term illnesses. That's not reflected in Western entertainment. And that is something you get from a show like Clannad.
Well, I could not disagree with what you just said more, but we're out of time. So, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the program and talking about Clannad. It was really great having you on. Really appreciated your candor and your expertise. So thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, it was a lot of fun. Love talking about this stuff with people.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Chris for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And I'll see you all next week.